Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of For the Medical Record. This is actually me and Antoine's last mini episode that we'll be doing together before the podcast takes a brief break and gets restarted with some other co-hosts from here at Hopkins. So
you will be left in good hands.
Yeah.
But we do thank you all for joining us along the ride.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we'll have one more episode after this. That's a full episode. But today we are joined by Matthew Klingel, who is an associate professor of history and environmental studies at Bowdoin College. And Antoine, you want to tell us about his work?
When he was here at Johns Hopkins Colloquium, he provided us with a chapter from his forthcoming book titled Sweet Blood, Diabetes and the Changing Nature of Modern Health. And the paper he presented was one of the chapters, which is titled Wear and Tear, an Ecology of Diabetes, Stress, and Discrimination.
Matt, it's so great to have you on For the Medical Record. Yeah, we're pleased to talk to you about your work. You presented at the colloquium at our department this week. Could you start out by summarizing your colloquium paper and your presentation? What are its main points, its main arguments, et cetera?
Hi, well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Christine, Antoine, and greetings from the wonderful state of Maine. So my colloquium talk was titled Wear and Tear. And that's a quotation taken from my primary sources. So Wear and Tear, an Ecology of Diabetes, Stress, and Discrimination. And the chapter is part of a larger project. This chapter is looking at stress and particularly how structural racism could be understood as another environmental factor in the larger environmental history of diabetes that is my project. And I start by beginning with the story of Jackie Robinson, who died of complications from diabetes at the very young age of 56 years of age. But I use the story of Jackie Robinson to go back and look at how African-American scholars, such as people such as W.B. Du Bois, helped to advance ideas of structural racism and economic hardship could generate illness and cause premature death. But that for most of the 20th century, there were other explanations that were being advanced by scholars such as Walter Cannon and Hans Seeley, primarily looking at stress as very much a manifestation of sort of modern life, particularly in white-collar labor. But then by the end of the 20th century, the rise of first civil rights and experts such as Kenneth Clark, who's prominent behind the Brown v. Board of Education decision with his studies that he did with his wife, Mamie, on the psychological effects of racism, to the rise of the Black Power movement, particularly the Black Panthers, as an alternative way of community building and health activism. And then eventually the rise within cognitive science, neuroendocrinology, that there's an emergence of this idea called allostatic load. And that today, many people now understand that there's a biophysical neuroendocrinological mechanism by which stress can literally get under the skin and kill you. Most famous with both recent work by Susan Geronimus and her idea of weathering. And that's what the chapter was about.
That was beautiful and succinct. What led you to studying this topic and writing this paper? Could you tell us how this came about?
Well, it's part of a lot larger project, which is an environmental history of diabetes and chronic disease, tentatively titled Sweet Blood, Diabetes and the Changing Nature of Modern Health. And I was looking for a second project. My first book was on a completely different subject. I was looking at the entwined histories of environmental change and social inequities within American cities. And I basically wrote an environmental history of the city of Seattle to look at how those two things entwined over time in a city that's often held up as an iconic example of a city that is somehow close to, quote, nature, end quote. But in reality, the Emerald City, kind of like that's its nickname, the Emerald City, the city of Seattle. If you look at the actual Emerald City from L. Frank Baum's story, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, it was built with conscript labor. And it kind of masks the history behind that. So I was looking for a second topic, and I was writing a history essay for a handbook by Oxford University Press on consumers and consumption. And I was literally wandering through the library, and I wanted to do a section of this historiographic essay on consumers and consumption. I sat down, saw this book that said Diabetes, a Disease of Civilization. And I picked it up and read it, kind of like St. Augustine of the Stacks, and was off to the races. And why this particular chapter on stress is that as I began to think about the question of environment and different etiologies of disease, it became apparent to me that I needed to find a way to talk about structural racism, structural inequality, what social epidemiologists call socioeconomic status or SES. And stress emerged as a possible theme, but I was trying to think about how to put it together. And a buddy of mine, Brian Purnell, phenomenally talented historian of civil rights, African-American history, 20th century history, called me up one day and he said, Matt, I'm reading this great biography of Jackie Robinson by Arthur Rampersand, who's a noted biographer at Stanford. And he said, you know, Jackie Robinson died of diabetes. I'm like, no. He said, you got to check it out. So I start reading the biography. And in there, Rampersand is talking with Robinson's wife, who had a nursing degree in MPH from Yale. And Rampersand all but says that Robinson's diabetes, and it ran in his family, was likely elicited or triggered by the stress he had being a pioneer breaking the color line. And he was diagnosed with it only about a year and a half, 2 years after he had stepped away from Major League Baseball. And after that, I started thinking more and more about it. And that's how I eventually came to the chapter.
Thank you so much. Starting with the Jackie Robinson, it's not an anecdote, but example, is a really great way to kind of hook your readers into the wider, mm-hmm. Historical context here, especially since this is going to be a book for a general audience. And, everyone in the American school system, learns about Jackie Robinson as this really important figure in 20th century American history. So I think that's a brilliant place to start. And it's great to hear the background of how you came to connecting him to this wider story. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. Speaking of connections and the wider story, could you tell us a little bit more about how this chapter on stress, this wear and tear chapter, fits with some of the other chapters? Or you can just tell us about some of the other chapters in this book.
Okay. Great question. Let me try to fit this in with the larger book, which is tentatively titled Sweet Blood, Diabetes and the Changing Nature of Modern Health. The title itself comes from an older term that many people living with diabetes use to describe that they have the disease. They either say they have the sugars, they have the sweet blood. And I like it because it plays with the idea of diabetes as this cultural thing, but also a material thing. And this tension between materiality and culture is really one of the motive driving forces behind environmental history. And so what I'm trying to do in this book is to think about how diabetes is something that, first of all, is important to understand as a material phenomenon. But it's also something important to understand as a cultural phenomenon, and it really coheres in ideas of environment, and particularly how it is that concerns over chronic disease more generally, and particularly diabetes at the end of the 19th century, emerges this moment when supposedly there's this worry about all these diseases of civilization and modernity. And this moment also coincides with a variety of other a couple of important things. It coincides with rise over concerns about race. It rises with concerns over industrialization. It rises with concerns over capitalism. It also rises concerns over this alienation of people from nature, whatever you want to call that. I begin the book by basically saying that at the end of the 19th century, there's this concern, but it's also this massive revolution in energy and other relationships we have with the natural world and with one another. And so, for example, you have the rise of this agro-industrial complex, but it's more than just the fact that all of a sudden we go from eating grain to eating Cheez-Its. It's not that simple. The Great Plains, this buffalo grass commons, eventually gets turned into this giant feedlot, if you will, to produce plant and animal matter for consumption on a mass basis. And this coincides with the Haber-Bosch process to make anhydrous ammonia, basically cracking the hydrocarbon molecule, and all that puts a lot of energy into human bodies. In a sense, I call it this perverse energy crisis. And then I go on to look at how the therapy that helped transform what we would today call type 1 diabetes, insulin, would have been impossible, even though it was discovered in 1922, impossible to make on an industrial scale were it not for this massive transformation of the planet's resources, because you needed all those cattle and swine pancreases to make insulin. And I was able to get into the archives of Eli Lilly and basically see how Lilly was the first company that was given the go-ahead to create the initial industrial processes, and then they had to sell it. And then the other chapters go through looking at other alternative etiologies of diabetes. So looking, for example, at chemicals, endocrine disrupting chemicals, or looking at, say, for example, changes to the gut biome, or looking at stress, as we just talked about. One chapter in particular looks at the NIH studies with the Pima, or as they call themselves, the Ocumla-Otum, an indigenous community that lives in central Arizona. In 1964, this study of this community helped revolutionize in many ways understandings of diabetes, but the ideas that the NIH researchers were bringing forward were very much focused on evolution, focused on genetics. For example, why is it these indigenous peoples have such high prevalence and incidence of type 2 diabetes? But the Akimala Atam, as they call themselves, the river people, saw their illness as stemming from the seizure of the river that once gave them life by American settler colonists. And so eventually over time, these two frames began to merge and create an alternative understanding about the origins of the disease. And then I conclude with the COVID-19 pandemic and that the coronavirus epizootic that jumps from animal population into human bodies both can cause diabetes. Increasingly, a lot of evidence suggests that, as well as people have a far more difficult course of the disease and a greater comorbidities or mortality with coronavirus disease. And not unsurprisingly, a lot of that tracks with pain fidelity along lines of race and class, not unlike diabetes itself. So the question, again, asking ourselves is, how is it that we can think about this chronic illness as something that folds over time and space and is an environmental topic?
Fascinating and brilliant. And I just want to say and give a shout out to my good friend and your former student, George Amwat. And I just want to say I'm extremely looking forward to reading your book, as well as one of my mentors, Rick Mizell. He's writing a book on race and diabetes. So I think that both of you are going to change how we think about diabetes and what we think we know about diabetes.
And if I can just put in a plug for Rick's book, Rick's book's going to also look at a lot of the comorbidities that are tied to socioeconomic and particularly racial status, like amputations and end-stage renal disease and dialysis. And that's something that is, it's really powerful to see that, like so many topics, this is something where so many people approach it in different ways and have this really great conversation that you hope as a scholar will be able to help to change some of the ways in which we think about it as a society and perhaps maybe address some of the underlying reasons why bodies and the body politic are sick and getting sicker sometimes.
Nice. Thank you. But yeah, shout out to you. Shout out to Rick. Shout out to George. did anything surprise you in the process of doing this research? And I'm really curious about that after your colloquia yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Projects take you in a lot of places you don't anticipate, both personally and professionally. You have to go where the materials are. I never thought, for example, that one of the trails that I would follow would take me to Oklahoma City, where I found the collection of Kelly West, who in many respects is considered to be one of the progenitors of modern diabetes epidemiology. He was a professor of medicine at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, and I picked up his book on diabetes epidemiology and just sent an email out into the ether. And some folks at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Library wrote back and said, yeah, we have his papers. We have a graduate student in library and information sciences that is willing to go through and catalog the papers. Would you like to come down and take a look at them? And so I kind of felt like I was following the surveyors for the railroad. Like this woman was literally accessioning the papers as I was following along behind her.
Thank you so much. We've got one last question, but you've already answered it really in talking about the conclusion of your book and relating this long history of diabetes to the COVID-19 pandemic. But the last question that we always ask in these mini interviews is, how do you feel your work relates to debates, questions, and practices of medicine today? Do you want to add anything to what you already said about relating it to the COVID-19 pandemic or anything else?
So one thing I'll say is that having written one book before and having gone out in the world and also being the father of a young person who's about to go to college, another one who's starting high school, you kind of really don't know what your progeny at home or your progeny intellectually are going to do. And with apologies with using a reproductive metaphor. So in a lot of ways, I have hopes, but it doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to come to pass. I often think a lot about writing this book with some of the other things that I teach, because I wear two hats. I'm both a historian at Bowdoin College, liberal arts college, undergraduate only up in Maine, but I also teach environmental studies. And it's hard when you're writing about something like diabetes not to think about things like climate change. And that those are stories that seem to, when we talk about chronic disease and we talk about climate change, they're stories that seem to be one not so happy thing after another. And yet, if you think about chronic disease, people live with illness. they're able to transcend some of the consequences of it. And there is something to be said also about having hope, even when there may not necessarily be hope. And I'm not trying to either trivialize diabetes or climate change, but that it's important to remember that stories that may not seem like they're this trajectory of uplift, that they seem like more of a story of decline, and that as historians and scholars who have a commitment, I hope, in my case, at least speaking for myself, to the common good, that we can see those stories as something that can be changed and also something that in their own way can provide a sense of hope.
That's such a great answer. Thank you so much, Matt. We're going to go ahead and wrap up now. Thank you so much for being our guest today. Yes. And for talking to us this week when you were visiting.
And thank you for being our last colloquium speaker for this semester, because you sent us out on such a high note.